It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin reflects a nationwide trend. Deaths by suicide are rising. We shed light on local community work to prevent these tragedies. And please take care, as this is a sensitive conversation. There is help through 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, providing confidential and free support. As we discuss mental health and suicide prevention, you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue Mitchell-Metz is a death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist and community advocate in Fond du Lac. Sue, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Looking at that CDC report, suicide rates rising in Wisconsin. Last year, 16 more residents died by suicide statewide than in 2021. Does this uptick mirror what you're observing in our state?
Yes, it does. Unfortunately, we do believe that it has some relationship to COVID with the lack of socialization and not being able to be out in the community. But I think there's still research being done on that for sure.
Does the rise concern you? Do you see that there's a way to try to address this so we could bring down these numbers?
So that is why I do what I do. It definitely concerns me. And I have been working within Fond du Lac County and surrounding areas with several different organizations to try to help prevent suicide and to be there for the community, both for those who may have or exhibit suicidal ideation, as well as those who have lost loved ones to suicide.
What should be done to support people who are having suicidal thoughts?
I think the biggest thing is to just validate their feelings and not bring that stigma into the relation or into the conversation. We really just need to validate the feelings in a non-judgmental way. And sometimes just sit and listen to them is all they need. And if they do really need further help, if they are suicidal at the moment, you know, getting the help using that 988 number you talked about with the national hotline, that is a national hotline that you can either call or text, or, you know, worst case scenario is calling 911.
How do you think the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is doing as a prevention tool? What is your take on it?
I really think the concept is great. I think the education and getting the word out there is still important. I know it is being used, but I think we could see higher numbers.
Hmm. Can you help us understand the stigma and the misconceptions about suicide? What issues do you observe?
Yeah, so I think this time I can bring in my personal experience. So almost 6 years ago, my oldest son, Ryan, died by suicide at the age of 30, leaving behind a 7-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. And at that time, suicide really was not in my vocabulary, which really shocked me personally. Being an ER nurse by background and EMS, I faced it every day, but it wasn't something I really openly talked about, even with my growing adult children. And so it made me realize that it's time we normalize this conversation, just like we normalize talking about drugs, alcohol, and even sexual relationships.
I'm so sorry for your loss. How did Ryan's death affect your perspective on mental health and suicide?
So with his death, he did not have a diagnosed mental illness that we know of. So it really alerted me to the fact that so many people are suffering. In fact, 1 in 5 people, according to the CDC, most likely have a mental health issue. And over 50 to 70% of them do not seek help. because of the stigma. So it really alerted me to this information and allowed me to go out and start doing presentations in the public. I start as young as fourth grade. I have been certified through NAMI, a National Organization on Mental Illness, to provide these kind of talks to the fourth graders, eighth graders, high school. And then on my own, I've taken it upon me to talk to college students, hospitals, law enforcement, and even churches.
We're talking with Sue Mitchell-Metz, who is a community advocate in Fond du Lac and a death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Sue, what was that journey like over these 6 years? How did you and your family heal in the aftermath of Ryan's death?
I can tell you it's very individualized. I actually witnessed this through myself, my children, my husband, and my granddaughter, as well as extended family. For me personally, I think I did not realize I was not healing for almost the first year. Others saw it in me and saw that I was going to a really dark place myself, and I didn't even realize it. I knew I didn't care if I was here anymore, but I really did not have thoughts of hurting myself. But my family physician thankfully saw that and kind of extended a help in giving me ideas that maybe I should look at therapy and medication, which together they have literally saved my life. Extensive therapy I went through. My daughter at the time, she was 22 years old when he died, and she turned to drugs and alcohol. So I struggled with that and was trying to help her through that and keep her alive. And she is, I can happily say, 2 years free of drugs and alcohol, come this November. My youngest son, he was 20 at the time of my son's death, and he up and moved to Utah thinking he could run away from the issues, and realized a couple years back that wasn't the ability either, or the right way to cope. So he learned that he had to also face the issues and work through them with mental health help. And then my granddaughter, children grieve very differently than adults, and they grieve sometimes in little spurts. And then as they go through the different age categories, so school age and young teenager and such, they go through different grieving types as well. So I've learned that with her, that I've had to share the story. And I said right away to her mom that I want her to know the truth in the ways that she can understand them from day one. I did not want to hide the truth because I wanted her to feel like she could come to us if she start having any of these feelings and emotions that she didn't know how to work through. So from day one, we told her her daddy took his own life. I'm not sure we used the word suicide for maybe another year or two till we thought she understood that concept. But we did many walks as a family to support suicide loss in mental illness, and we included her in all of it. So she wears shirts proudly and talks about her daddy all the time to all of her friends and family.
Thank you for sharing all of that. You also sought further education in this area as well. What made you go that direction?
I did. So, after my son's loss, I did learn that lived experience brought a lot of credential to the plate when talking to others. However, you still always have those people who may say, but what makes you the expert? So I really wanted to have that if I was going to do the education and public presentations and really support those in the community. I wanted them to know I really understood in both lived experience and education. So I did go back to school. I did receive a second master's. And that one was in thanatology, which is a study of death, dying, grief, and bereavement. And after school, I actually took a national test. So I am a certified thanatologist, which means I am a specialist in death, dying, grief, and bereavement.
We have Sue Mitchell Metz with us. As she said, death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist, a survivor of suicide loss. As we learn how to talk more openly about suicide, how to save a life, you can be part of this discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of people who died by suicide hit an estimated record high last year, according to provisional figures released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We meet a community advocate in the Fond du Lac area with lived experience approaching this topic with care and compassion. You can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share a perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue Mitchell Metz with us, a death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist. Sue, talking about your presentations on mental health for fourth and eighth graders in the Fond du Lac schools, what are you seeing and hearing from students with the willingness to talk about mental health struggles and suicide?
So I was a little leery going in the very first time I did this, knowing my granddaughter at that age was not very talkative to people she didn't know. And so when I went in, I was amazed at their willingness to talk and ask questions and concern, and really wanting to know how they could help their friend and make sure their friends were okay. They wanted to make sure their friends were not going to hurt themselves. So it was an amazing experience when I go in there.
How did your talk and presentation differ from fourth graders versus eighth graders?
So fourth graders, when we talk about mental health, sometimes I'm not sure if they completely understand the term. So I like to bring it down to what I call brain health. So we talk about heart, and they always do like jump rope for heart, you know, for heart month. So we talk about the brain as an organ and talk about brain health. So we share a lot more that way with education. By the time we get to eighth grade, we know that they understand the concept much better. So we're able to really dig deep into the concept of suicide and the warning signs, what to watch for, how to help your friends and watch for changes.
Warning signs, you've emphasized the importance of mental health screenings in schools. What do you hear from students in these mental health screenings?
So when we talk to them, usually they like to first talk about others, and we have to bring it back to them. And so as we do screenings with these children, we find out that, you know, a lot of them have a lot of things they suffer through both at school and at home, bullying and either dabbling in drugs and alcohol, or even drug use and alcohol use by eighth grade is more prevalent. And sometimes it, you know, is from, you know, we often think like single family homes and homes where parents are working or the kids are alone. And we're finding that is not necessarily the only families that are suffering. We have home kids that are coming from homes with a mom and a dad in the house full time, and they still can suffer from depression and different mental health issues. And so we really are trying to get every child screened.
Some studies point out that LGBTQ plus people have higher rates of factors that increase the risk of suicide. And as we see states attempting to put more restrictions on transgender people in particular, what effect could that have on this mental health issue?
Yes, we are seeing that those in LGBTQ do prevalently show higher rates of mental illness. And I think it is because they don't understand always what their feelings are and how they, you know, for instance, are born in a typical female body, but feel like they really are a male, etc. And then their friends don't accept them. And so then they just feel like they don't belong and they may get bullied. And I just think there's not enough support for this group. We're getting better and we're acknowledging, but I think that we need to acknowledge as a younger age.
What do you say to parents who worry their child is too immature to talk about suicide, not ready for a screening?
Given that my granddaughter was 7 when her dad died and I had to have the hard discussions with her, I don't think anyone is too young. If we're going to talk about drugs and alcohol, which we do start at a very young age with say no to drugs, we start with talking about our heart health. In kindergarten, we jump rope for health. So we just have to start talking about the brain as an organ and make it normalized, and then just continue the discussion to their understanding ability as they age.
Just perhaps a little bit of nuance here. What does the school districts that you go into, what do they do with the screening afterwards? How is that handled?
So there's a couple different things that can happen, depending on how they score on their screenings. We do have in Fallon County schools that I specifically work with, we do have in-school mental health professionals that will provide additional care and support. And if we believe that they need additional help or potentially family counseling, we do make referrals out into the community so that we make sure that they're being taken care of. And then we follow up and to see if their needs have been met and if there's anything more we can do. So we don't just leave them at that point.
We're talking about suicide with Sue Mitchell-Metz, a Fond du Lac community advocate and a death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, or share a concern, 800-642-1234. Sue, last year, more than 500 suicides involved the use of a firearm, and the State Health Department reports that the number being the highest in 30 years. How do you discuss guns?
So, again, depending on the age level, I mean, we always talk about that children should not touch guns, and that we hope that parents have them locked up. We frequently, if we do like a education fair, we will have somebody there that provides free gun locks to the public and to gun owners. But again, we just open it up and normalize it. We don't keep anything back.
I understand you also make a point to share your personal experience with suicide with law enforcement. Why is that?
So I do share with law enforcement because I just feel like we need to make sure that anybody who comes in contact with those who may be suicidal have the proper training. And we know that often for a suicidal person that law enforcement are involved and they are the ones we call when we call 911. That's who responds. So I think the information to them is very important that they understand somebody who is suicidal and what they're going through. My son personally had that interaction with law enforcement, and I feel that there may have been a break in the system in that he was not considered a threat to himself at the time he expressed that he was suicidal and that he was allowed to transport himself to a mental health facility in a neighboring city. And he didn't make it, unfortunately. So I just really want to educate everybody who might come in contact with those that suffer with mental health issues because they react and respond differently than those who are in an emergency situation, such as a medical emergency other than mental health, and potentially fire or car accident. Those people are looking for help. Those who are suicidal can fear others who might be coming at them and telling them what to do rather than trying to sit with them and explore what's going on.
Turning the attention to you in our final moments here, you didn't realize that you weren't healing. Your family physician was able to see that. How did treatment help? Did that help to move you to a new place, a better place?
Oh, yes. So, like I said, I was in a dark spot. I just didn't care. It was okay if I was here on Earth side with my children or if I was on the other side. And I am a person of faith, so I believe in heaven. So I didn't, if I was in heaven with my son, I knew I'd be with somebody that I loved very dearly. And so through therapy, I actually went through a process called EMDR, which really helped me to be able to process my thoughts and my emotions so that I can still think of my son and even think of his death, but it doesn't create that extreme emotion and anxiety and panic attack provoking emotions that I was experiencing.
Sue, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Sue Mitchell-Metz is a death, dying, grief, and bereavement specialist in Fond du Lac. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Those three digits are 988. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about two friends on an adventure 50 years in the making.
Two Wisconsin teenagers in search of adventure in the 1970s rode their 10-speed bikes from Anago, Wisconsin, through Minnesota, to the Canadian border and back. 50 years later, they reprised the 900-mile ride. As Jan Larson tells us, they had to make a few adjustments and had a new purpose.
Mark Blaske was 18 and Nick Schmelter 16 when the friends spent 9 hot summer days and mosquito-infested nights pedaling through the Wisconsin and Minnesota Northwoods. It was July of 1973. Mark rode his Rally Supercourse that cost him $149. Nick, his trusty Big Schwinn. Everything they needed, Nick says, they carried with them.
We had panniers and packs and sleeping bags, and we used tube tents, you know, basically a plastic tube. You strung a string between, and you tied that to trees or whatever you could find, and you sort of slept in that open-ended, which didn't help for the mosquitoes.
The first day, the teens racked up 140 miles before stopping to camp. Mark recalls, it was a rough night.
And we jungle camped in a wayside after that 140-mile ride near Fifield, Wisconsin, and by 10:30 at night, we were being devoured by mosquitoes. And I said, Nick, are you sleeping at all? No, I can't sleep at all. So we got up and rode 4 miles in the dark on Highway 13 to a little motel in Park Falls that cost us $3.50.
Averaging nearly 100 miles a day, the two completed the journey with nary a mishap. Well, nearly, says Mark.
We'd ridden the whole way. We were 15 miles from home. We hadn't had a flat tire, and I was getting cocky and just doing kind of a serpentine route down a very quiet country road and ran over a board with a nail in it and flatted.
The two did make it home. In the fall, Mark left for UW-Madison. Nick stuck around to finish high school before his own UW-Madison college years. The two drifted apart until 2020, when COVID found Nick holed up and looking for connection.
And I was Googling past friends, and I remembered the bike trip that we took in 73, and I Googled Mark Blaske, and I found his website.
It was a website showcasing Mark's art. Nick, now 66, and Mark, now 68, reconnected over the trip and life. As the 50th anniversary approached, Mark suggested a reunion ride. When they realized cancer had killed multiple loved ones, they decided to turn the ride into a fundraiser for cancer research. Mark contacted his alma mater and worked with the Carbone Cancer Center to set a goal and launch a website for donations.
This is where it all starts.
50 years older, the two modified their cycling plans. They rode the same route and stopped in the same places. But a team consisting of a young friend, Andrea Kubischak, who drove a support motorhome, and Mark's wife, Emily Blasky, who handled logistics, joined them on the ride.
One of the things that I think is so great about this is this renewed friendship. And I sort of want to be like a fly on the wall, on a rolling wall, watching these two.
After a week on the road, the cycling team rolled into Antico on July 17th, completing a second 900-mile ride to the Canadian border and back. And this time, without any flat tires. The ride, they say, made a difference for them. Nick says they hope it will make a difference for others, too.
What better way to make this worthwhile and be meaningful than to do it for something? You know, do it for funding. And I know we'll put a small dent in the cancer research, but it's a dent that we'll be proud of.
Jan Larson is a professor emeritus with the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine contributions of the Civilian Conservation Corps in the development of Wisconsin state parks 90 years after this Great Depression-era program put young people to work on infrastructure projects across the country. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Brewey worked for 30 years as an archaeologist in the U.S. Forest Service, heritage program manager for the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, now a National Heritage Management Consultant. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure being here.
Mark, the Civilian Conservation Corps was one of several New Deal programs championed by President Franklin Roosevelt. What societal and environmental problems was the program intended to address when it was started in 1933?
Well, the country was, of course, immersed in the Great Depression. Unemployment was 25%, although the unemployment of youth, that is, young men between the ages of 18 and 25 was about 50%. And secondly, of course, environmental degradation that was associated with over-harvesting of northern forests, overproduction of agricultural products, drought, and a number of other factors really required a means of addressing these problems. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt's solution, I think, was brilliant.
In Wisconsin alone, there were 182 camps employing over 75,000 men, as you mentioned, between the ages of 18 and 25. How were these camps organized?
The camps were organized by the Army, the Department of Army. And so it was Army personnel that deployed enrollees. And then when the camps were established, whether it be state forests, national forests, state parks, or national parks, there were specialists associated with the respective agencies who would ensure that the projects that were being done had the oversight that was required to do the work.
It just seems like so much coordination on so many different projects, and to figure out who knows what, who is saying yes to what. It seemed like a really major orchestration.
It was, and what's remarkable about it is it effectively began during FDR's first 100 days. So it was not something that took 6 months or 12 months to get going, but it effectively began immediately. So the mobilization, the organization was really pretty extraordinary.
You mentioned things that might not come to mind about what these projects were like. I mean, men worked on soil erosion. They worked on flood control projects. To what extent did this work relief program help reforest northern Wisconsin?
Well, I'm of course most familiar with Wisconsin's national forest, the Shawamigan-Nicolet, but the forest was essentially established about the same time as the creation of the Civilian Conservation Corps. And northern Wisconsin generally, and certainly the lands, the 1.5 million acres that would become the Shawamigan and Nicolet, were effectively cut over, burned over, barren lands. And there was essentially no way of addressing this problem at the time. The Forest Service was again beginning to purchase lands that would become the forest, but there was no forest there. And so these camps, and there were 30 to 40 camps in operation, for example, within the Shawamigan-Nicolet, began the work under the direction of U.S. Forest Service foresters and other specialists to begin replanting, you know, the millions and millions of trees to reestablish a forest, which today, of course, is remarkable.
That is remarkable to think that these men were putting in one tree at a time and reforesting this logged landscape. I mean, that is actually completely changing a landscape.
It did indeed. And it's amazing if you can see some of the photos, for example, that were taken on those landscapes that are now the Shawamigan-Nicolet and state forests, of course, as well, that were effectively treeless. You could look in places for miles and see nothing but a barren landscape in the 1930s. Flash forward to the 1980s, particularly, the forests were becoming well established and moving towards that the general composition of those forest communities that we see and enjoy today.
The Civilian Conservation Corps built shelters and fire towers, roads, of course, trailblazing, stone stairs that still stand on federal and state land in Wisconsin. How are these types of structures maintained today?
Well, if, for example, if they still have fairly good integrity, the respective agency, and I'm really going to go back to the Forest Service because I cannot speak, for example, for the state and how they manage those resources. I know they're managing them well. I know that they've moved forward with National Register of Historic Places nominations for a number of the Depression era sites that are within their parks. The Forest Service, for example, found itself having to look at a number of the campgrounds that were developed. And effectively, all the campgrounds within the Shawamigan-Nicolet had a CCC signature. That is, they were developed in the 1930s. You know, fast forward to particularly the 1980s and the 1990s, and many of the buildings and structures were becoming degraded or had been removed. So those that remained required significant restoration. And if I may say, as an example, for example, in the Shawamigan-Nicolet, there is a campground called Franklin Lake Campground, which we placed on the National Register of Historic Places. And there is a camp that people can rent, cabins called Lost Lake Camp in Florence County. Both of those campgrounds were effectively badly degraded. And in 2009, I believe it was, President Obama's National American Reinvention and Recovery Act dollars allowed us to restore both of those places to their original architectural and structural appearance.
Talking with Wisconsin archaeologist and retired heritage manager for the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, Mark Brewey is here, our guide to better understanding the impact of Civilian Conservation Corps projects in Wisconsin completed during the Great Depression era and that are still part of our parks today. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. 90 years after the Civilian Conservation Corps, we take stock of some of the projects around Wisconsin from the Great Depression era and what this infrastructure is like today, especially in state parks. Wisconsin archaeologist Mark Brewey is here, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, the work relief program ended nationwide in 1942, and many of the workers left to fight in World War II. What happened to these camps, these work camps in Wisconsin, and have any been preserved?
Following the termination of the CCC in 1942, and it really started scaling down certainly at the beginning of the Second World War in 1941, as you said, many of the enrollees ended up going into the military fighting in the Second World War. The camps themselves essentially remained as they were for a few years because, like, for example, whether it be the Wisconsin Conservation Commission, now the DNR, or the U.S. Forest Service, didn't have the personnel to do very much with them. Following the Second World War, many of the camps on state forests, national forests, were effectively removed. The buildings were removed and sold at public auctions or donated or essentially simply destroyed. Many of the camps themselves were effectively graded over. They were scarified for forest regeneration. Not all of them, though. There are some remarkable camps that effectively have escaped the destruction that came with redoing the landscape. There's an excellent example, for example, in Iron County near the community of Manitowish Waters called Camp Mercer, which recently the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Wisconsin DNR, and the Manitowish Waters Historical Society have created a trail in that camp and signing. There's another similar camp within the Shawmut-Nicolet National Forest in Oconee County that essentially has escaped much of the destruction. That, too, is accessible to the public. So there's a handful of camps, you know, out of those original 182 or so that still retain what we as archaeologists call archaeological integrity. Hmm. And importantly, those are places that we hope that agencies will look at carefully to become interpreted sites. For the public benefit.
Let's bring on a caller now. Joan is joining us near Superior. Joan, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Great show.
Thanks.
Our family has a wooden footlocker that was issued to our late uncle. He worked in the CCC camp. It has his name stenciled on it. It says CCC. And then there's a four-digit number. These letters are about 2 inches high. We don't know if he worked in a Wisconsin CCC camp or a Minnesota one. Unfortunately, all of that generation is gone now, and he actually died during World War II. We'd like to find out some history about which camp he worked at, and we have those numbers. Is there some way we can trace that?
There may be. The numbers may relate to a company, the Army assigned companies, effectively mobilizing the people, having them in companies, and then deploying them to camps. There's a number of online sources. There's one called CCC Legacy, which notes camp locations, company numbers, when those camps were in operation, and also Minnesota, Wisconsin. There's a online, I believe it's through the Wisconsin Historical Society, a publication called the 1937 Sparta CCC Annual. Sparta was a district that included Wisconsin, Northern Illinois, and I believe part of Minnesota. You could search that, and perhaps you could come up with some names. You could come up with photographs of the people that were in the CCC company. Other than that, you know, again, you may want to contact the Wisconsin Historical Society and see if they can provide any additional information regarding archival information. Regarding the artifacts themselves, the box, I mean, that's all very interesting stuff. And there is a remarkable CCC museum in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, that displays a number of things and can provide some additional information regarding your interests, I believe.
Joan, thank you so much for calling in, and hopefully that helps with tracing some of the things that you have found. You know, as we talk, Mark, and I'm going to reintroduce you, Mark Bruy, civilian, as we talk about Civilian Conservation Corps in Wisconsin. Mark is retired heritage program manager for the Shawamigan-Nicolay National Forest. You can join in 800-642-1234. I think to me, the breathtaking impact of the CCC is actually at the crest of the Sandia Mountains near Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there's the CCC trail. It goes straight up the ridge, or no switchbacks. And then at the very top of the mountain peak, they built a cabin. Like these men built a cabin, and you look out, you know, 10,000 some feet over this beautiful, beautiful valley below. And to me, I just wonder, how could you do this without modern industrial equipment? How could this even be possible? What is breathtaking to you about the accomplishments?
You know, I love your example, and it's been years since I've been there, Kate, but it is a remarkable place. I think in Wisconsin, you know, whether it's visiting, for example, Devil's Lake State Park and walking those trails that were constructed by the Civilian Conservation Corps crews, you know, there are so many places where that CCC, that is parks and forests in Wisconsin, where the CC signature is there. And, you know, I mean, it's oftentimes not really interpreted. So I am a strong advocate for interpreting historic resources for the public benefit. And, you know, I think as time goes on, more and more of this work is being done. Again, I mentioned a camp, Camp Mercer, but in terms of places, you'll note interpretive signing, for example, in state parks that will just be a reminder of the good work that the CCCs have done. It's the trails, it's the bridges, it's things like that throughout our state that are still so remarkable. And we hope, of course, many of those will be preserved for the long run.
In our last few moments, is it difficult to get the camps or projects listed on the National Register of Historic Places?
It is a process, and it's a process that needs to be done by, you know, specialists, whether they be historians or archaeologists, depending on the resource. But no, it's not that difficult. There's great direction that's provided by the Wisconsin Historical Society, in terms of proceeding with those nominations. Again, not something generally done by members of the public, normally by historians or archaeologists. It's not that difficult, but it does take time.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Bruy is Principal Investigator and Compliance Specialist for Commonwealth Heritage Group. It's a national heritage management and consulting firm, an archaeologist retired from the U.S. Forest Service. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.